The number of charges that are filed today are the greatest number of charges that we filed in a single day in the history of the state of Alaska for Medicaid fraud charges.
The state charges 29 people with fraudulently billing Medicaid. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, investigators begin looking into the Soldotna plane crash.
The way the wreckage is laying will probably give the investigators a better understanding of what might have happened just prior to impact.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The state is prosecuting the largest Medicaid fraud case in its history. The Medicaid Fraud Division filed charges today against 28 personal care attendants who take care of elderly and disabled people in their homes. Department of Law Division Director John Skidmore says the cases represent about $360,000 in fraudulently billed services.
The number of charges that are filed today are the greatest number of charges that we filed in a single day in the history of the state of Alaska for Medicaid fraud charges. And the amount of money that we're talking about for citizens within the state of Alaska is the largest amount that we've gone after folks for in the history as well. There are other multi-state settlements that have resulted in millions of dollars against large corporations, most of them drug companies, but nothing for individual citizens in the state of Alaska that's been as large as this.
According to the charging documents, the investigation started after a nurse who works for the state's Division of Senior and Disability Services tipped off the Medicaid fraud unit in February. A 91-year-old woman reported to the nurse that she was pressured into accepting personal care attendant services from an employee of Good Faith Services. The woman said the attendant then stopped coming to her apartment. All but two of the personal care attendants charged in the case work or worked for Good Faith Services. Skidmore alleges most were involved in one of two schemes.
Billing for services being provided at the same time, supposedly for more than one individual, so you can't be two places at once. Following along that same theme of being in two places at once, people who were charging for services provided when they weren't even in the country, that's a large majority of the types of fraud that we were looking at.
The state is also charging one Medicaid recipient for allegedly splitting funds with their personal care attendant. The state is not filing charges against Good Faith Services at this time. The company's lawyer, Chester Gilmore, says according to the charging documents, the fraud was widespread but very specific to the individual personal care attendants.
It's easy to walk away from these kind of numbers and think that Good Faith Services itself somehow profited from this or their business had some sort of advantage from it. But that's absolutely not the case. This kind of small-scale fraud would be, you know, disastrous to this company. It would not be in this company's interest. This company's interests are precisely what they're doing, which is cooperating with the government.
Gilmore says the company tipped off the state to the actions of some of its employees who were allegedly committing fraud. He says the company employs about 300 personal care attendants. The state's Medicaid fraud unit has double the number of investigators it did a year ago, thanks to a bill state lawmakers passed. Andrew Peterson is director of the unit. He says the extra investigators have allowed the state to significantly boost the number of cases it's prosecuting.
The idea is that with a more active presence by a Medicaid fraud control unit addressing, you know, these type of crimes, that in addition to gaining restitution for the state by bringing back the money that was fraudulently paid, we can also, deter others who might have thought it was a good idea to defraud the Medicaid system and will have a second thought now once they see what's happening within the industry.
As of today, none of the personal care attendants charged in the case will be able to bill Medicaid pending the outcome of the charges. After getting a no from the Department of the Interior, Governor Sean Parnell has doubled down on a plan to conduct seismic testing in a section of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Today, the administration offered a new plan, pledging more money to get to the effort and argued that the federal government was legally obligated to consider their proposal. But already there are questions over whether this is just another round in a decades-long game of chicken between the state and federal government. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
In the second press conference in as many months, Governor Sean Parnell reaffirmed his commitment to finding out just how much oil there is in the refuge.
But it's important for Alaska and our country not just to be on defense, but to go on offense. That's why we've moved into the second phase of our ANWR policy.
The phase he's referring to involves pushing harder on the federal government to allow 3D seismic testing inside a section of coastal plain called the 1002 area. Parnell introduced a testing plan in May, and the initial idea had been for the state, federal government, and industry to team up and conduct winter studies of the area over the next 3 years. It would have cost about $150 million, with the governor proposing the state pay for up to a third of that. But in late June, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell rejected that plan, saying that the window for doing seismic work in ANWR closed in the 1980s. That's where the change in the governor's strategy comes in. The Parnell administration is now charging that Jewell's interpretation of the law is wrong and that the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act obligates the federal government to review their plan and offer an answer in 120 days. And they've offered a new plan that would have the state shoulder most, if not all, of the financial burden at the start.
This is not meant to be a partnership with the federal government at this point.
Whether the Interior Department will even consider the new plan is unclear. Spokesperson Jessica Kershaw says the secretary remains opposed to oil exploration and seismic testing within the refuge, but that they can't speculate on a plan that they haven't seen and a permit application they haven't reviewed. Meanwhile, environmental groups opposed to development in ANWR are skeptical that the governor's plan to conduct seismic testing has any chance of moving forward. Lydia Weiss works for the Alaska Wilderness League, and she calls it a non-starter.
This is a policy that is not supported by Congress, not supported by the president, not supported by Secretary Jewell, and not supported by vast majorities of Americans. So why waste time and resources and money going over this?
For his part, Parnell was vague on what the state would do if the federal government blocked his plan, but didn't rule out litigation.
We will cross the bridge of what we do in response to a negative or a decline by the secretary if and when she gets to that point. But I'm not going to be able to speculate on that right now.
The last time the federal government seriously considered development in ANWR was in 1995, when Congress voted in favor of drilling but was ultimately vetoed by President Bill Clinton. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A federal agency has again said no to an endangered species listing for a species of ice seal found off of Alaska. The National Marine Fisheries Service announced today it is rejecting a listing for ribbon seals, as it did in December 2008. The agency says in an announcement that anticipated threats from reductions in sea ice and disruption to prey will result in a gradual decline in ribbon seal population numbers. However, the decline is not expected to put them in danger of extinction in the foreseeable future. Ribbon seals are found in the Bering and Chukchi Seas and off the Sea of Okhotsk off Russia. Ribbon seals during summer live entirely in water. From March through June, they use loose pack ice for reproduction and molting. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Seward fourth grader has a memorable interaction at the White House.
He asked me what my dish was, and so I told him it was Alaska ceviche with mango.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Federal investigators arrived on the Kenai Peninsula yesterday to examine the scene of a Sunday plane crash in Soldotna. They plan to pore over evidence at the crash site for the next week before moving their operation back to Washington, D.C. At a press briefing late this afternoon, NTSB board member Earl Weiner released a few more details. He says the propeller was in rotation when the plane crashed, Investigators also recovered three more cell phones from the crash site. Two were recovered earlier. There were no eyewitnesses to the accident. Weiner says most of the bodies were still buckled in their seats. One local pilot and nine passengers who were visiting from Greenville, South Carolina, were all killed after the plane crashed and caught fire late Sunday morning. KBBI's Ariel Van Cleve has this update.
Milton and Kimberly Antonakos and their children, Olivia, Mills, and Anastasia, along with Chris and Stacy McManus and their two children, Connor and Megan, were heading out for a bear viewing trip on the Alaska Peninsula. Radisky Air owner Walter Radisky was the pilot for the day. Something went wrong a little after 11 a.m. National Transportation Safety Board member Earl Weiner says it's likely the plane crashed on takeoff, but they aren't sure how high it may have gotten.
The way the wreckage is laying will probably give the investigators a better understanding of what might have happened just prior to impact. The engine is intact. The propellers are bent. We have a propulsion specialist who is currently looking at that to understand how much power the engine may have been producing at the time of impact.
An NTSB GO team arrived in Soldotna Monday to get a look at the damage. Lead investigator Dan Bauer says each member of the team will look into specific aspects of the crash.
Specialists looking at the power plants, and they would be examining specifically the engines. Specialists looking at the airworthiness, examining the structures and the systems. And specialists here examining the aircraft operations and operation of the company.
Weiner says investigators also will look into the amount of weight that was on the plane and check weather conditions for that Sunday morning. According to the National Weather Service, conditions at the time of the crash were cloudy with a temperature of 55 degrees. Winds were out of the west at about 5 miles per hour, and there was visibility of about 10 miles. The fact that the de Havilland DHC-3 Otter was not required to have a voice recorder or in-flight data recorder on board will prove to be a challenge. Investigators will not be able to pick up clues from those, but Weiner says they did find two cell phones in the wreckage. The NTSB lab in Washington, D.C. might be able to pull information off of them. Weiner says investigators are on the scene of about 1,500 general aviation accidents like the one in Soldotna each year.
With 1,500 accidents a year, you see the same thing in repeating itself often. A loss of control accident, this may be what that turns out to be, is really an accident type that reoccurs too often.
He says investigators will likely start from the understanding that the crash was a loss of control accident and look for evidence to prove or disprove that idea. A preliminary report is not expected for another 30 days. In Homer, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
69-year-old Peter Tony is in jail in Bethel awaiting court proceedings for multiple charges of child sexual abuse. Meanwhile, his case keeps growing. It's evolving from two sides, the past and the present. A 4-year-old alleged victim and a 48-year-old alleged victim. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
Kimberly Bruch is Peter Tony's stepdaughter who says he abused her when she was 8. She says her abuse lasted for about a year, but the aftermath went on for decades. She says it wasn't traumatic, at least at the time. Tony would climb into her bed and fondle her.
I kind of imagine maybe this is just what daddies do with their little girls. And it wasn't violent. There was no threats involved or anything. And it made me uncomfortable. And I tried to squirm away and pretend I was asleep and get between the mattress and the wall. But it was not particularly traumatic at the time.
The stress manifested itself in other ways. She started having nervous behaviors. She clawed and picked at her skin until it bled. For Kimberly, the statute of limitations has run out to press charges, but she knows she doesn't want anyone else to suffer the same way.
I started pursuing this case in earnest, trying to figure out how I could get someone in authority to care enough to look over the records and connect the dots.
Through her own investigation, she's discovering that there could be other victims. A former foster child accused Tony of abuse, leading to the revocation of his foster care license in 1998. Later, Kimberly's mother, Marilyn Tony, ran a daycare out of her home. Kimberly has reached out to those parents and connected to the 4-year-old's family who is now pressing charges. For Kimberly, though, help didn't come for years. She never told anyone about the abuse until she was 15. Her mother confronted her stepdad about it, but he denied it. Her mom suggested the three talk about it together, which Kimberly refused. The same year, she moved out of the house to live with her boyfriend. She was married by 17. At that same time, Kimberly's younger sister came forward, also accusing Tony of abuse. Their mom took both teenagers to the Division of Family and Youth Services. They were interviewed by social worker Mary Achak, or Mary Abruska at the time. Nothing happened. There was no follow-up, and Kimberly just pushed it all aside again.
It also left me feeling that the abuse I reported must not be very serious. You know, I wasn't actually raped.
Reports have recently surfaced in other media that the social worker had been romantically involved with Peter Tony, but they haven't been confirmed. Kimberly was also silenced for years by the unexpected response from her husband.
He was very angry with me for reporting the abuse, so much so that he punched a hole in the living room wall.
That relationship lasted for 18 years, during which time Kimberly was estranged from her family. Meanwhile, the other Tony sisters were dealing with the aftermath of their own abuse. Both Robin and Teresa committed suicide as adults. The extent of her sister's abuse only became clear to Kimberly this past year when she found Teresa's suicide note. It told of the abuse and asked for justice. With the support from her brother, Doug Tony, Kimberly has been going after that.
I'm wanting to come public with my story because I'm really hoping that more victims will be able to come forward, more victims of Peter Tony in particular, in this case, and just more victims of this crime in general.
Kimberly says she feels totally healed. She's come to terms with Tony's abuse and her sister's suicides.
I have forgiven him. I don't hate him. I think it would have been wonderful if he could have been exposed years earlier and gotten help for his problem.
She doesn't know how many victims there could be. Bethel police say they could go back to the 1970s. But what Kimberly says she does know is that the time has come for the heavy burden of shame to be lifted off their shoulders and carried by their abuser. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Admissions representatives from Brown University, MIT, and from Yale University are hosting college information sessions to discuss academic programs, campus life, selective college admissions, and financial aid. On Saturday, July 13th, the session will be in Anchorage in the Assembly Chambers at Lusac Library. And on Sunday, July 14th, the session will be in Juneau at the downtown branch of the Juneau Public Library. Register online at admissions.yale.edu. This message sponsored by Yale University.
Crews battling the Stewart Creek 2 wildfire northeast of Fairbanks have made significant progress. But as KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, an evacuation watch for residents of nearby Two Rivers and Pleasant Valley remains in effect. For firefighters, it could be a race against the clock. A warm, dry forecast could bring red flag conditions back to the region by the end of the week.
The sky over Fairbanks is gray, but not from smoke. Clouds and rain have dominated the forecast in the region for the last 24 hours. Richard Hadley is a public information officer with an incident management team assigned to the Stewart Creek 2 fire. He says the weather has helped keep growth of the fire to a minimum.
We got light rain across the whole fire yesterday, which knocked down the fire behavior. And that's now allowing firefighters to get right up on the fire's edge and construct what we call direct line, and that'll minimize the acreage.
Hadley says firefighters have gained control over some of the most critical areas of the fire, where it's burning near homes along Chena Hot Springs Road.
We were able to call area between milepost 24 and 30, where the fires reached the Chena River. We've now called that controlled, so we're now at 15% contained. And the acreage is a little over 82,000 acres.
Officials don't anticipate the fire will grow significantly over the next 2 days, but warm, dry weather could prompt red flag warnings later this week. That has firefighters scrambling to gain an upper hand.
It's going to change dramatically here, so we're going to see the temperatures go up. We're going to see relative humidities drop into the teens, and then strong winds out of the north. Northeast are projected. We're fortunate we have the maximum number of crews in here that we can really utilize. And the next 24 hours, we need to knock out as much of this containment line as we can in advance of changing conditions.
Firefighters from all over the country are battling the blaze, including crews from Maine, Minnesota, and West Virginia. To date, the fire has cost more than $6.5 million. Richard Hadley says much of that comes from fighting it by air.
You know, we've got 12 helicopters operating, as well as all the air tankers. And that's a large cost, and it's been needed on this fire because so much of it was inaccessible. And then when the fire was making those big runs, really the only realistic way to safely fight it was from those air resources.
Hadley says although two injuries have been reported, neither was serious.
They didn't require medical emergencies, and we believe that those firefighters will probably be back out on the line here within a day or so.
Despite progress, officials say conditions are still serious for residents of Two Rivers and Pleasant Valley. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
More than 1 million acres have burned in the 446 wildfires in Alaska this season. That's an area larger than Rhode Island. Many of these fires are left to burn if they aren't a threat to people or infrastructure, but the most dangerous of them are battled by hundreds of firefighters and other support personnel. Some fires even warrant their own incident meteorologist, or IMET. APRN's Josh Edge has the story.
Firefighters know weather conditions can change the direction of a fire, putting those attempting to contain it in a potentially deadly position. But specially trained meteorologists, or IMETs, work with fire crews to help better predict the path a fire may take. There are just 85 certified IMETs nationwide that are prepared to go anywhere in the U.S. on just a few days' notice. Their specialized work helps to keep fire crews and communities safe. Michael Richmond is an incident meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Anchorage. He's been part of the IMET crew since 1990 and has been sent to over 25 of these dangerous fires. When he first started, technology limited the effectiveness of the microscale forecasts.
Before the internet, all we had to use were what were called Dyfax charts. We had a little satellite dish that would download these paper charts for all of our radar, satellite pictures, and forecast graphics. And they were tiny, and they were fuzzy, and that's all I had to go on.
But Richmond says technology has caught up, greatly increasing his effectiveness in the field.
Now we have real-time data of all sorts, lightning, satellite, radar, everything. And it's a completely different world. And I feel so much more confident. So it's we have almost as good of capability in the field as we do in the office now.
When an IMET gets deployed, they stay in what's called the Incident Command Post, where the suppression efforts for that specific fire are coordinated. The command post can sometimes be in very remote areas, which means IMETs need to bring full camping gear. And despite the remoteness, Richmond says the fire camps certainly aren't stuck in the Stone Age.
I've seen fire camps develop in 24 hours with full satellite communications, kitchen facilities, laundry facilities, shower facilities. It's really amazing how quickly they can set up a large fire camp with tents, a computer network, electricity, communications, everything.
Despite the high-tech camps and improvements in the technology, Richmond says there are still some limitations. In 2006, he was at a fire near Stanley, Idaho, in a camp that was situated about 20 miles away from the fire line. The area didn't have radar coverage, making it impossible for him to provide an accurate forecast.
Sure enough, a small thunderstorm developed and brought winds of 40 to 45 miles an hour, pushed the fire toward the crews.
They were able to escape, but it was more than an hour before the command post knew they were safe.
So there are realities that we just have to deal with in this business, and that's one of them, is that you're not going to have everything you need, and that the firefighters have to follow and be able to follow their standard orders and get out of those situations when they occur, because they will occur.
So far this season, the only place in Alaska an IMET has been dispatched to is the Stewart Creek 2 fire near Fairbanks. Currently, there are 91 active wildfires in the state. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Four kids from every state and some U.S. territories dined at the White House today. They were chosen as winners to attend the second annual Kids State Dinner. APRN's Peter Granitz caught up with Alaska's delegate, Seward resident Rowan Bean.
Rowan Bean is only 9 years old, but has the culinary creativity of a professional chef.
Alaska ceviche with mango.
Which is?
Basically, salsa with fish in it.
And cooked with a concoction of various juices.
I used lemon, lime, orange, and grapefruit juice.
That Alaska-Caribbean fusion won Rowan a free trip to the White House. She was chosen to represent Alaska at the Kids State Dinner, part of First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. Each dish had to follow federal food guidelines set by MyPlate.gov. That's the new iteration of the old food pyramid. The carbohydrates in Rowan's dish come from the fruit, vegetables, and whole grain tortilla chips. And to get the dairy requirement, she washes it down with a glass of milk. The First Lady told the assembly it wasn't easy getting to where they were.
You all stood out among a pool of more than 1,300 submissions for this contest. So this was no easy task. You know, if you deal in statistics and odds, the odds were, you know, pretty tough getting one of these seats at this table. So you should be very proud of yourselves.
The state dinner, actually a lunch, came complete with all the pomp and circumstance of any world leader sit-down, White House China and butler service included, something the First Lady made note of.
We set this event up and we mirrored it exactly to what people experience when we host world leaders here. We were in this very room, that receiving line you had to sit through, stand through. We do that.
The trip was a whirlwind for Rowan and her parents. She's going into the fourth grade, and her highlights of the trip were a visit to the National History Museum, where she saw Dorothy's ruby red slippers and the original Star-Spangled Banner. But most memorable was the surprise pop-in by the president.
He asked me what my dish was, and so I told him it was Alaska ceviche with mango.
Rowan says she explained to the president how she came up with the dish. She likes cooking salsa with her mom, so it all started there. And it helps that cooking is in her blood. Her father, Eric Slater, is an executive chef at a resort near Resurrection Bay. He accompanied her to the White House lunch.
She's a good sous chef, absolutely. If I can just get her to do some dishes every once in a while, maybe.
And music to his ears, Rowan says she wants to follow in the family footsteps. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ariel Van Cleve in Soldotna, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources. The Alaska Public Radio Network, in cooperation with our member stations, provides the most complete, timely, and accessible source of Alaska news, current affairs, and cultural information.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.